Good to be together. I'm glad you are here. Thank you so much to the men who've led us this morning through the acts of worship as we've devoted this time to God and to praising Him. Thank you so much. Again, a big thank you for all of those who are able to be here yesterday. We had an awesome day, evening together, I should say. We had a good number here. It was such just a good activity for us to join together in. This morning, as we think about 1 John chapter 2, we're going to come back there in just a minute, and that will be kind of the key cornerstone of what we're going to talk about. But as we talk about these things, I want to go back to John 13. If you'll go back to John 13 with me for just a moment. And you may remember, as we were talking last week, the disciples are there with Jesus. And as they are partaking of the Passover, Jesus gets up and he goes about washing the feet of the disciples. And in this discussion, as John reveals this to us, he makes some interesting statements about Judas. If you go to John 13 and verse 2, the text says that during supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. Later on in that same text, it's noted in verse 27, then after he had taken the morsel, Satan entered into him. And Jesus said to him, what you're going to do, do quickly. So that phrase in verse 27 there where the text says Satan entered into him, that's a scary kind of idea, isn't it? A lot of horror movies have been kind of built off that premise of possession, right? The idea that Satan would possess someone to come in and to take over them and to rule them. So the obvious question that comes to my mind is, what is meant from the text that Satan entered him? Did this mean that in some way Judas had become possessed by Satan or his demons, and they had made him betray Jesus? That in some way Satan was the one really responsible here and not Judas himself? What's meant by the phrase? When we think about this idea, and of course there's an obvious connection between Satan entering Judas and the concept of free will. Did Judas have his free will removed? Well, a little slow today. Can you advance that sign? Did Satan take away Judas's self-control and the responsibility over his free will? Well, as we think about that, and after we discuss this for a minute, I hope to make it clear why I'm bringing this up. But if you go and look at the text there, it says Satan entered him. Is that taking away Judas's free will and his responsibility? Well, I want to back up for just a minute. I want to go back to John chapter 6. And we'll have to advance it that way. I'll kind of point at you, Si, when I need to go forward. But in John chapter 6, as Jesus is beginning his ministry, he's selecting his disciples, those who would follow him and eventually become the apostles. It says that that as he did that, John 6 and verse 70, did I not choose you, the 12, and yet, what? One of you is a devil. Verse 71 goes on to explain, he spoke of Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, for he, one of the 12, was going to betray him. So from the very beginning, we note that Jesus had foreknowledge. He knew in even the selection of Judas what Judas would do. That even before Judas himself would know, Jesus knew what his action would be. However, I think it's important to note that Satan entering Judas doesn't come until much later, until the night of the Passover. So just note that connection. Jesus makes that prediction here at the very beginning, and yet it doesn't occur until the end of their ministry together, until that very night. So it's characterized, as Jesus characterizes him, as a devil, as a demon, there in John 6 and verse 70. A couple other passages I want us to note in this regard. So is Judas being possessed, or is he acting out of his own desire? Go to, if you will, go to John 12. John 12, this is a little bit before the events of the Passover. John chapter 12, verse 4. You'll note that in that text, in that context, you have Jesus at the house of Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. This is the time when they're there together, and then Mary brings out the spikenard. She breaks it. She then begins to pour it over the feet of Jesus, and she begins to wipe them and clean them with that very expensive spikenard. The text reveals to us that as they're there, Judas becomes very upset. In verse number 4, Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, he who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" So is Judas all concerned about the poor and making sure that they're not being wasteful of money? Well, John explains to us that's not the case. In verse number 6, John explains that he, Judas, said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. His motive was not benevolence. It wasn't even stewardship. But he simply brought this up. He simply complained about Mary because he wanted that for himself. He was a thief, and having charge of the money bag, he used it. He used to help himself to what was put into it. So he was literally stealing from Jesus and his disciples. And he had made that a practice. And he was upset about this. He was so upset that when you go to Matthew 26, in Matthew's account of the same activity, Matthew reveals to us in Matthew 26, 14, then following the events of Mary washing the feet of Jesus, afterward, one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priest and said, "What will you give me if I deliver him, Jesus, over to you?" And they paid him 30 pieces of silver, and from that moment he sought an opportunity to betray him. What you notice again, the statement about Satan entering him hasn't occurred yet. And yet, what is Judas doing? He's seeking an opportunity for betrayal. What does that mean? Well, what Jesus says in John 13:27 has nothing to do with some kind of mystical demon possession. It all has to do with Judas and his lust, his desire for someone else's money. He did it out of greed. Out of evil intention, he sought an opportunity to betray Jesus. It may be easy for people at times, and it is common to our human nature to blame others for our sinful activity. We've been doing it since the beginning. If you go back to Genesis chapter 3, in the garden when Adam and Eve sinned, what did both of them immediately do? They wanted to blame somebody else. You see, even in that narrative, Eve, when it comes to her, who's she blaming? Satan. Now, Satan has his own sin. He committed his own evil. But her activity was not something forced on her by Satan. She made that determination. She is the one who made that decision, just as Adam did, just as Judas chose to sin. So do we. In James chapter 1 and verse 13, James says that let no one say when he's tempted, I am tempted or I'm being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But, verse 14, but each person, you individually, is tempted when he or she is lured and enticed by his own desire. Our sin, our sinful activity, really resides from a temptation in our own heart. It comes from our own desire, our own lust. You commit adultery. That began in your heart and in your mind. It began when you began to look at someone else in an improper way. When you steal, it's not some demon who possessed you and made you do it. When you commit violence against someone, that's not Satan's fault. Now, Satan may tempt us into doing that. He may work on the things we desire, but the desire, the temptation comes from within. You go to Matthew 26 again. Matthew 26 and verse 23. You note in the conversation Jesus has with Judas. Judas is fully aware. Verse 23, he answered, Jesus, he who dipped his hand in the dish with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written, but woe to that man, Judas, by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born. And then notice verse 25. Judas, who would betray him, answered, is it I, Rabbi? He fully knows the answer to that question, doesn't he? And Jesus said, you have said so. Judas didn't do what he did because he was forced in it or compelled in any way. Judas did what he did because that's what he wanted to do. That's what he desired to do. Sin comes from a desire that is all too personal for us. Judas, it seems obvious to me from Scripture, had the temptation, the weakness for greed. And Satan definitely played on that greed. Satan laid before him a trap, and it seems to have been sprung ultimately when Mary put that spikenard on the feet of Jesus, and that amount of money was just too much for Judas to overlook. And he gave in to his temptation. I remember, I don't know if you've ever had to use these, but you remember those, some of us may have them even now, those mouse traps that have the nice heavy spring on them? You ever catch your finger in one of those suckers? It hurts. You know, when those things spring shut, you hear it, don't you? The thing is, Satan is much more subtle than that. He lays those traps before us that we don't see often, either because we refuse to see or because we're blinded in some way. But he springs them on us. And if we are not prepared ahead of time, sometimes they get sprung on us. Satan tries to lay his traps. Jesus says that Satan entered Judas' heart. Metaphorically or symbolically, that's what happened. That's not the choice we have to make. In Revelation chapter 3 and verse 20, Jesus said to the brethren in Laodicea, Jesus has no good words to say about Laodicea. You go back and reread that text. But he does say this. He says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." Just as much as Satan wants to get into your heart and into your mind with his temptations, with his lures, with his traps, so does Jesus. Jesus wants to get into your heart, into your mind. But you know, Jesus isn't going to trap you. He isn't going to give you some fancy lure like you're going out to, you know, to the lake or to the ocean and trying to lure some fish onto a hook. Jesus doesn't do that. He provides us with truth. He invites us. He encourages us. Just as much as we can invite Satan into our heart, we can invite Jesus into our heart, into our mind. Jesus said to those brethren, "If you will answer my knock, I'll come in and we'll dine together, we'll sup together." But you notice how that's a choice. I often heard that said that door to your heart and mind, it can only be opened from one side. And that's the inside. There isn't some knob on the front that Jesus is trying to, he's going to force his way in. There simply is a knob on your side to allow him in to your life. So, as we think about this, I want to go over a couple ideas here about the traps of Satan. How are you and I going to overcome the evil one and avoid the traps that he puts before us? What are the things we ought to be looking for? As you know and as I know, what temptations I have are very personal to me. Our desires are not the same often. But I do, because I've lived with me for a long time, I'm well aware of where I'm weak, and so are you. And so it is incumbent on us to be aware of our weaknesses, our temptations, our desires. Now, we also know something else. Those can change. The desires you have today are probably not the same desires you had when you were much younger. Those evolve and change as time changes us, as life changes us, as we have different experiences. Yet, it is so vitally important that you and I think about these things and consider the sinful lust and desires that knock at the door of our heart and our mind. I want to give a couple ideas here. Let's go back to 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2, and I want you to notice what's said here in the text. 1 John chapter 2, and verse Let's begin reading there in verse 15. Let's just read this again together. He says in verse 15, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and the pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires, but whoever does the will of God abides forever." And so John is laying out for us a choice, a decision that we have to make and make on a daily basis in looking at our lives and the temptations we face. I want you to notice something here in verse 15. This is fascinating to me. So we talk about in the Greek language. When we look at the word love, you may know this if you don't already. There's not just one word for love. You know, we use the word love in a lot of different ways. But in Greek, they had different terms that denote a different idea or concept of love. You might think about the word phileo, right, which is the brotherly love. There's also a word in Greek for family love and for manic love, like crazy fanaticism, right? There's all these different words. Well, often when talking about God's love for us, there's a word called agape. And agape is a love, and I've heard many scholars consider it the highest form of love because it's a sacrificial love, right? It's a love where I'm willing to do whatever it takes in order to act in a way that is for your good, right? I'm willing to sacrifice my own needs and desires. You think about John 3:16, that very famous verse. For God, what? So loved, so agape the world that he gave his only begotten son. God was so desirous for mankind's benefit, God sacrificed himself in order to provide a way of escape. Right? So that, often speaking about God's love for man, we see that term. Now, what is fascinating to me? Go to 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15. Notice that text one more time. Do not love the world. Do you know what word is used there? Agape. Talking to us. He says, do not agape the world. Think about that. How John, the Holy Spirit through John, has flipped that in looking at us. And how so many human beings live their lives. They live their lives with the kind of desire, and we would label evil desire, for the world that God desired for humankind in the most perfect way. Do not sacrificially love the world. So many are willing to sacrifice everything for physical pleasure. Anytime we choose sin, we are saying to God, I want this more than you. Isn't that amazing? What a thought. You look there, do not agape or love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves, agapes the world, what? The agape, the love of God, is not in him. That's the battle going on with us, with you individually, and your battle with sin and mine. It is this very dynamic idea of this complex relationship between us and God and us and the world. And what am I going to choose today? Am I going to choose to love God, or am I going to choose to love self and the world and the things in the world? Because anytime I choose to love the world, I am saying to God, I'm choosing it over you. Jesus said you cannot love what? God and mammon, or God and material things. That's the same concept as what John is talking about right here. I'm going to have to sacrifice one or the other. I cannot have both. I cannot have the things of the world and God. I'm going to have to make a choice. So John says, do not love the world or the things in the world. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life, the three great traps of Satan. All sin goes into one of those three categories. Your desire can be and is in one of those things. Either it is a desire of the flesh, or the desire of an eye, you know, what you're seeing. Or it is coming back to the pride you have. For all that is in the world, the desire of the flesh. In Genesis chapter 3, isn't that what tripped up Adam and Eve? You remember at the beginning of that narrative, Eve is saying what God wants her to say. And yet, Satan works on her desire. And if you go back to Genesis 3 and verse 6, the text says, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desired to make one wise, she took its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. She saw that it was good for food. She lusted after that fruit. How tasty it must be. The man or woman who finds themselves in the arms of a person they should not be with has looked and said, wow, wouldn't that be nice? And what they're essentially saying is, God, I'm going to sacrifice you and my family for these few moments of physical pleasure. Desire of the flesh. Paul in Romans 7 says that is just emblematic of this struggle that I'm in. Romans 7, at the end of the chapter, he says, oh, wretched man that I am! Who will save me? Who will save me from my flesh? In Matthew's account, and I'm going to kind of lay these side by side because they're so similar. You have in Matthew chapter 4, Jesus has been out fasting in the wilderness and praying to God. And it was at the end of that 40 days of fasting that Satan decides this is a great day to come at him and to tempt him. In Matthew chapter 4, it says, and after 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. You notice Satan didn't just come at any time. He came at the time when he was the most hungry. And I can only imagine what that must have been like. I don't like going one meal without food before I'm hungry. I think you know what I mean. And yet he's been 40 days of this fasting where he's very much limiting his intake. And here Satan comes. And the tempter came and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread." I think there's an implication in that, is that Satan knew something and he's speaking a truth. Jesus could have turned those stones to loaves of bread. He had that power. He's not going to tempt us at things that are beyond our control. When a temptation comes, 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13 says, "It is common to man." The temptation is in breaking God's covenant. And so Jesus responds in verse 4, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God." He knew better than to begin to listen to Satan. His attention was where it needed to be. When Satan tries to tempt us, one of his tricks is he tries to get us distracted. Satan in the garden was trying to get Eve not to focus on the words of God, "You shall not eat." He tried to get her to focus on what? On the fruit. I bet that was a tasty fruit. I don't think he was lying to her. She was lying to herself when she said it was good for food. I bet it was very tasty. But I bet it was a lot like John in the book of Revelation. You remember when he was told to eat the scroll? And he said it was very good in the mouth, but what was it in the stomach? Very bitter. That's what sin is. It tastes really good on the initial. It's what happens afterwards. Jesus understands that the words of Satan, the temptations of Satan, may taste bitter or may taste sweet in the mouth, but are always bitter in the stomach. You've done that, right? Have you ever done that where you've eaten too much? Man, it was good when you sat down at the table. Every bite, man, that was so delicious. But you ever got home and, man, that belly did not feel so good. I shouldn't have eaten that. I shouldn't have eaten so much. Right? That's kind of the idea or concept there. Let's be forward thinking enough not to just think about the moment we're in, but what's the outcome? Don't let Satan get you distracted from God and from God's word. Go back to that concept of love there. Eve decided to sacrifice God and her daily walk with God, her presence in the garden, her life even, for a momentary pleasure that fruit would bring her. What are we sacrificing? What are our idols? What drives you? What drives your temptation, your desire? What is it that you serve, self or God? Number two, not only was she tempted, and 1 John chapter 2, 16 tell us that it's not just the flesh, but it is the desires of the eyes. Now, eyes are flesh as well, so obviously he's not just repeating himself. What does he mean, desires of the eyes? I think here what he's really getting at is what is intaked into the mind. The gateway to the soul are your eyes. John says that for all that is in the world, these are the things that are worldly, the desire of the flesh, the desire of the eyes. Again, in Genesis chapter 3, you can go ahead and put up the next one. In Genesis chapter 3 and verse 6, she saw that it was good for food, that it would, she felt, taste very good, although she's never experienced it before, but she had looked at it enough that she thought, man, that must be a tasty fruit. But it was not just that, but it was the desire that it was pretty, that it was attractive. The eyes are one of the areas where Satan pulls at our attention and our focus and tries to get us to look into places we should not look. That old adage about sin will what? Take you where you don't want to go. It will keep you longer than you want to stay. It will make you pay more than you ever wanted to pay. I think that's so very true. And that's what Satan wants us to do. He wants us to grab our focus and attention. Go to the book of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 12. What does the beginning of that text say to us? After talking about all these men and women of faith and putting all this focus on, you need to be a person of faith. You need to hold on to your faith. In the very next verse, therefore, since we are so encumbered or surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, all those men and women of faith, since we have all that knowledge of their lives and how they lived, we ought to live like that. Looking or fixing our gaze and our attention on who? On Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. We need to run our race with endurance, letting go of the weight that so easily entangles our feet. I'm paraphrasing there, but that's, I believe, the concept there. Get rid of the weights that hold you back, the traps that ensnare you. Focus your eyes, your attention on Jesus. Make the Word of God the premier thing in your mind. Again, in Matthew chapter 4, isn't that what Jesus does? Matthew chapter 4 and verse 8. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in their glory. And he said to him, all these I will give you if you fall down and worship me. All that was before him, Satan said, I'll give it to you. All you have to do is worship me. And this goes back to 1 John chapter 2. What are you willing to sacrifice? What are you willing to give up in order to have your pleasure and desire met? Far too often we're willing to give up the very thing we need the most, which is God and the love of God. Satan says, if you'll fall down and worship me, I'll give it all to you. Jesus said, be gone, Satan. For it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you worship. Jesus knew where his focus and attention had to be. You think about what are your idols? What are the things you sacrifice for? What are the things that hold your attention? Are they really worth your soul? Jesus said, what would you give up in exchange for your soul? The answer, obviously, is nothing. However, far too many people have a long list of items they're willing to sacrifice their soul for. The desires of the eyes. And then lastly, if you go back to 1 John chapter 2, verse 16, he says, the pride of life. Pride of life. I think the Proverbs writer has something to say about this, doesn't he? Pride goes before a fall, destruction before a haughty spirit or somebody who's arrogant. Pride is one of those things that will trap us in and will ensnare us. If you go back to Genesis chapter 3 and verse 6, again, what did she notice? That it was a tree desirable to make one wise. What was the lie she swallowed? Do you remember what the lie was? Well, there are a couple. Number one, you shall surely not die. That was Satan's first lie. The other one is, you shall be like God. You should be like God. I've often thought about this from this perspective. And I often have trouble understanding where atheists and agnostics come from in their desire to want to remove God. But it really is back to this concept, I believe. And it comes out of an arrogance. An arrogance that says, I should be in control of my own life. I should be the ruler of my universe, the determiner of my destination. No God, no other person should get in my way. And it's stupid arrogance. In Psalms, the psalmist said, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. In Romans chapter 1, Paul, writing to the Romans, says that out of ignorance, they wanted to remove God from their consciousness. It's a very arrogant and yet nonsensical thing to believe you're in control. Because what life teaches us over and over again, although some of us are a little bit more stubborn or hard-headed, we have to learn this lesson over and over again, is that really we control so very little. We can't control other people, though some of us try very hard. We can't control life's happenings to us, though we make all kinds of plans. How often do we find ourselves finding those plans not working exactly the way we wanted them to? The one thing we do have control over, and that is our personal response to God. Desires to make one wise. She thought, arrogantly, she could be like God. There was no way it was ever going to happen. Yet she bought the lie. You're not in control of your life, and neither am I. That may come as a shock to some of us, but that's just the truth. The one thing you do have control over is that's your actions. You do control your destiny. Now, that's only there because Jesus died on a cross. If he doesn't die on the cross, you don't even have control over that. So God provided us a gateway to that, didn't he? Again, in Matthew chapter 4, Satan tempts Jesus again and says in verse number 6, after taking him and setting him on the pinnacle of the temple. Isn't that interesting? He put him on the temple. Whose temple is that, by the way? That's his temple. That's where Satan set him. And said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. There's also kind of a neat implication from Genesis chapter 3, with the foot and the stone. You remember in the curse against the serpent, you shall bruise his heel, but he shall crush your head, or bruise your head. Satan says, throw yourself down and you'll see the angels come up and protect you. Jesus said in verse 7, again it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. It's an arrogant thing to try to test God. Yet we do it all too often. Some people wrongly and very sadly believe that at the end of all this, no one's going to go to hell. God's just going to forgive everybody. And it's all going to be okay. It's a very arrogant thing to believe. God has said over and over again, what's going to happen and the importance of getting your life right, right now. In your life, you have control over the here and now. Is your pride preventing you from humbling yourselves? Is our pride getting in our way of doing what God has called us to do? As we close this out, we ask one final question. What is your greatest desire? To serve God or to serve self? Do you love God? You probably have said that before. Many have. Far too many believe it. Far too many people live it out. Far too many times when people say they love God, that's not who they really love. What they really love is the world and the things of the world. But hopefully, it's not true of us. What is your greatest desire? Who are you serving? And whom's are you? This morning, as we're assembled together, we have an opportunity to obey, to make a change. Maybe in your life you have been loving the world and things in the world. Maybe that has been your desire. It does not have to stay that way. God's given you and me another opportunity, hasn't He? Would there be a more perfect time than now to make things right? You don't have to continue in the state you're in. If you're not a Christian, you can become one this very day. Are you a Christian who's fallen back in love with the world and not loving God as much? This warning is for you as well. Whom will you choose? If we can help in any way, please come as together we stand and as we sing.